Hello and welcome back to Inside the Business of Sports, the sports podcast from Cleveland State University featuring my mentor, Professor K, Jim Kaler, Cleveland's sports business professor, and myself, Michael Carlisle, a current student at Cleveland State, learning the ropes, and we have got another great guest with us today. We are joined by none other than Ron Wilner. But gentlemen, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to be here again. Jim, we've been cranking these things out, and we've got another great guest today.
Well, and Michael, you've taken the intro class, so you remember the module we did on facility management. Well, today's guest, Ron Wilner, is an expert in facility management, and we're awful lucky to have him as an adjunct member of our faculty. And also, you know, when he's not helping us out at Cleveland State, he's the vice president of venue operations with the Cleveland Orchestra and also helps oversee everything out of Blossom Music Center. So, Ron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you both. I appreciate the invite, and it's great to be here. Look forward for the next few minutes to get together and talk about facility management.
All right. But, Ron, before we get going on facility management, I want our audience to know that you bleed green. You're a Cleveland State grad.
Yes, and
everybody's talking about what will happen to the Wallstein Center, and we're going to get our new arena sooner or later. But when the Wallstein Center first opened is when you and I met. Mm-hmm. You were the general manager of the Wallstein Center. So take our audience through kind of your background and how you broke into the sport and entertainment industry.
Sure, absolutely. Basically got started on the campus back in the mid-80s. I was hired through the university as a purchasing agent. And part of my role in that office was to oversee the new then CSU Convocation Center breaking ground back in 89. And then basically overseeing the procurement of equipment, supplies, everything that goes into an arena, and had the opportunity to open that building in 91. One of my former mentors, Jay Collier, who the university brought in to run the building, wasn't on board very long. So he basically got us open and started, and I kind of started in the event services business with him. Moved on to an assistant GM, then the GM role. The university thought it was wise at the time to bring in a private management company, which they did through Center Management out of Landover, Maryland. And Center Management was actually owned by A. Poland, who owned the then Washington Bullets and Washington Capitals. Abe was a great guy. He only had a few buildings in his portfolio. Ours was one of them. He had the Baltimore Arena. He had the Capitol Center where the then Bullets played, and he also had a building in Hartford, Connecticut. So very few buildings.
All right. So we got to know each other back in the day when I was down the street at the arena, Gund Arena, today Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse, and, you know, some friendly competition where we'd both be going after certain events. But you guys at the Wallstein Center had a couple of marquee concerts that you took away from us. Remember back in those days and some of those times?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. There was some very good, strong competition going back and forth. Unfortunately for us, we had 5,000 less seats, so we weren't going to get the marquee names. But I think we held our own by getting an Elton John, a Tom Petty. We did Beastie Boys. We did a lot of various events in the building that you might now see at Rocket Mortgage, but you see now how we've developed, or we did develop back in the day. We had the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament. The men's championship in 2000 and 2005. We hosted the men's NCAA wrestling championships, and we also hosted the volleyball Final Four as well. So we did a pretty good job of booking the building. We did a pretty good job of holding our own for being just two blocks away from you guys down the street. But I think it was friendly competition.
All right. So as we get young students like Michael coming through our program, we're going to see that a certain percentage of them want to get into the operations side of the house and would aspire to do what you've done. That is like be a general manager of a building. Like most kids, and Michael, you could attest to this, you know, the first week in campus, they want to be the next general manager of the Browns or the Guardians or the Cavs. Yeah. But there's a lot of arenas and stadiums out there. So there's a lot more general manager jobs of facilities, big facilities, smaller venues out there. And this is definitely a career path that people can find their way into.
Correct. I mean, we basically are looking at a platform of venues across the country that are run by private management facilities or basically run by the city or government or a university itself. But when you take a look at the scope of buildings that an ASM Global or an Oakview Group have in their portfolio, most of the time, Super Bowls, NCAA Final Fours, are played in buildings managed by one of those two companies. And those two companies build a platform and a basis to help people, train folks, get to be better served in a GM role, help them with a growth pattern in a GM role in their facility, and so on. So they provide the training tools and resources to help grow in that field. But you're right, Jim. Everybody wants to come on board. First thing they want to do is be a GM. No one wants to start in a ticket office. No one wants to start, you know, in the box office or marketing or things like that. They want the GM position, whether it's on the team or in the facility and so on.
All right. So over the next several minutes, I'm going to be throwing some questions your way. And then I'm going to bring Michael in to throw some questions from a student's perspective. But let's get going with our first question. And that really is, what are some of the biggest challenges that facility managers face in running professional arenas, stadiums, college athletic venues, performing arts, large amphitheaters? I mean, at the end of the day, I got to think the challenges are somewhat similar. So share with our audience, if you will, what are the challenges that you would face in a job like that?
So I like to look at it as pre-pandemic and post-pandemic challenges. And pre-pandemic, you know, I had the luxury of opening six venues in the Northeast Ohio area. Aside from the Wohlstein Center, I did open the Convention Center in downtown Cleveland, the Global Center for Health Innovation, the Public Square, new renovation of Public Square, and so on. Various challenges in all of these different venues, indoor facilities, outdoor facilities. But when you look at pre-pandemic, we had different types of crowds in each of those scenarios. You know, you've got the much larger rock crowd basically taking on, you know, seats in Wohlstein Center, a younger generation. You've got some grunge acts taking place, you know, crowd control issues, things of that nature. You come over here to the orchestra and the performing arts side, and it's a much quieter atmosphere. Now you're kind of whispering, and you hear very little radio traffic. You know, you kind of wonder if your radio's on at different times because there's no noise. There's a sense of quietness, you know, no phones, no cell phones. But when you go into a whole different element in a large arena, it's a much bigger picture, a much more, you know, rambunctious crowd and so on. Same thing with an outdoor football stadium or even an outdoor amphitheater like Blossom. We've got two different schools of thoughts at Blossom. You've got the Live Nation aspect where it's rowdy and noisy. You've got the orchestra aspect where it's quiet and peaceful, and people want to come out and have a great time with a picnic basket and their families and things of that nature. So a lot of the challenges right now are faced crowds coming back from the pandemic. You know, how have we come along?
Right. And in your opinion, are we back to full speed? Have we learned much coming out of COVID? What are your thoughts there?
We are not. I don't think we are back full speed yet. I mean, we're getting a sense of people still showing up in mass, still people being leery of where they're sitting. We have crowds arriving later than usual that we've seen in the past. It's just a whole element of people, their change in their pattern of their whole lifestyle of coming to a performing arts center or coming to an outdoor amphitheater. We did all the measurements in place. We had the screen checks. We had the vaccination checks. We have the mask requirement, you know, must wear a mask. We did our due diligence in seating people 6 feet apart, things of that nature. So we actually had to put all of that in place to start slowly bringing crowds back, which we did a couple years ago. And now that that is somewhat back, we're getting to where we were in 2019, you know, pre-pandemic time. We're seeing much larger crowds now. You know, Severance Music Center here is now filling up We expect to see Blossom Music Center filling up too on the lawn and the pavilion and so on.
All right. So in you basically talked about this, but how do facility managers balance the needs of different stakeholders? So in some cases, you got to keep your basketball coach and your athletic director happy at Cleveland State, but then now you got a rock and roll promoter coming in. They have different needs. Fans have different needs. So when you're scheduling all this together, how do you balance all of that?
It's a very, very challenging matter. Let me tell you, when I was at Wolstein and the GM, priority dates went to the university commencement. So if you want to get the lay of the land as to who gets what first, university commencement was first. Then it was the CSU basketball. And we had to sit down with both coaches, both athletic directors, and lay out a practice schedule, lay out a game schedule. And if, of course, as you know, at the university, we have both a men's and women's program. So you've got Title IX issues you got to watch, basically looking at if the women are practicing in the auxiliary gym and the men have the arena practice time, then you've got to flip-flop the next day. All the while, you're trying to still maintain a concert schedule, a family event schedule, and so on. So here at the orchestra, it's much more challenging. You've got an orchestra that rehearses four times a week and performs four times a week. So to try to bring in any other outside rental business or concert becomes a major challenge on scheduling in our building. Trying to keep all the stakeholders happy is really, really a challenge. You've got different cultures and different personalities taking place. And, you know, out of Blossom, the orchestra gets crack at the first dates, and then we turn our calendar over to Live Nation, and then they proceed booking their dates from that point on. But back at the university again, it was very, very challenging in terms of we had the opportunity to bring in large-scale events, and you look at the calendar, you say, well, we've got a women's basketball game, and unfortunately, we couldn't do it. So Title IX issues didn't allow us to bring in a John Cougar Mellencamp or, you know, another Tom Petty concert and so on. So we had to kind of bite the bullet and watch them go slow to your old neck of the woods down the street.
So. Yeah, well, we were happy to, take any additional event we could get.
That's right.
So, Ron, in your career, you've seen great technological advancements and different tools that are now part of facility management. Why don't you share with Michael and I some of your insights on the role that technology has played in your career so far? And if you're looking into your crystal ball, what's going to be different with tomorrow's venues? And you know, and then I want to, you know, get into a conversation about the future of Cleveland State. But like, walk us through the technological advancements that you've seen and give us a peek into the future.
Yeah, I basically came on board at Wolstein when on sales were at the box office on a Saturday morning at 10 a.m. and there was no website purchase. There was no online buying. You know, the scalpers had people they paid to sit out front and camp out overnight to get the best tickets possible. And then you see the adoption of basically the online ticket sales and things of that nature. Here at the orchestra, we pretty much, we're kind of still old school in some fashion. We do a lot of things in person at the box office. So there's very little technological advances here at the orchestra. But out at Blossom, we've seen a much larger change in the scope of technology with the use of video boards for messaging. We see a lot of different technology on cashless systems at concession stands and box offices. We see different apps being used. You know, Live Nation has their own app for entry into the gates and things of that nature. So everything seems to be online or on an app. And that's probably the biggest major change I have seen over the course of the last 30 years.
And all right. So this is a great time to bring Michael on the conversation. Michael's he and his wife are raising three kids. So now he's going to be taking them to events and the world is going cashless. Well, Ron, to you and me, that's going to feel a little weird, but Michael, that's almost like status quo in your world with your generation, right?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I didn't really ever carry cash once I maybe got past the age of 17. I was always using, you know, credit card, debit card, things like that. And with the advent of all of the apps that are now available, I don't even have to have paper tickets. it's actually weird to me when I get a paper ticket instead of being able to just scan a QR code on my phone. Okay, great. Come in. I go to Guardians games. I go to Cavs games, all of those things. And it's all QR code right online. So being able to, I don't know what that transition was like, but I'm sure it was a big step forward and probably helped with getting people inside the building.
Yeah, and Michael, I want to come back to you just for a second, because in one of our earlier shows, you were talking about taking the kids to a Monsters game, Cleveland Monsters. So there's your kids watching hockey, and now they got this gigantic Jumbotron center hung in the middle of the arena, and you were talking about technology. Your kids are watching the Jumbotron as much as they were the game.
They were probably watching the Jumbotron more than they were watching the game, especially because me and my son, we actually made it up onto the Jumbotron. So everybody was very, very excited. But having those things, being able to have these massive screens, I also think it's going to help keep those younger viewers, of regardless of what event you're at, probably more engaged, because they are used to having that screen and maybe not necessarily watching the action.
Yeah. And Ron, so let's look into our crystal ball. Cleveland State has released its master plan over the next 10 years. And you and I have talked offline about, well, what will the size be of that new arena? Will it be 5,000 seats? Will it be 7,000 seats? But one thing I think we can rest assured on, it'll have a center hung video scoreboard, right?
Right. Very, very critical. I mean, you know, the old Wolstein, but the four corner scoreboard at Wolstein is just a really bad, bad element to watch any type of sporting event, because you've got a giant green curtain blocking two of those scoreboards. And when they first put it in, they thought it was the greatest thing ever, because you could look in any corner to see the score. But lo and behold, it wasn't as great as they thought it was going to be. Everybody wanted to come in, put their event in there, and asked where our center hung was. We didn't have one, because we had a monorail sound system in the middle of the arena that basically, where the sound speaker cluster would move back and forth, you know, prevented us from putting any type of scoreboard system in there. And yeah, unfortunately, so for us, was not a luxury at all.
So let's stay with this new arena. Personally, I'm a big fan of college basketball coaches, so I'd like to see it be about 5,000 seats, because if it were, we're going to have closer to capacity crowds. There are some argument on the other side. Well, maybe we go with 7,000 seats so we can get some. Cleveland doesn't really have a 7,000 seat concert venue. Where would you weigh in on what you think the right size of that venue should be?
I'm between that 6,000 and 7,000 number, and strictly because I agree it's a good number for basketball. But the flip side of that is, concert sight lines. You know, we look at, you're not going to get concerts at 7,000, 6,000 people. You've got to draw the line of where the stage is set, where the sight lines are. So if you can get sight lines for patrons between 4,000 to 5,000 people, Cleveland doesn't really have a size venue where you could put 4,000 to 5,000 people. You want to be better than Playhouse Square, because you're still at that lower level of seats. You're going to be in competition with Playhouse Square. That becomes your biggest competitor now, is Playhouse Square, in terms of comedy shows and concerts and things of that nature. But again, basketball is a little tricky. You know, we've never really had a strong powerhouse of a team. Back when we opened the Convocation Center in 91, we actually opened the building with the Fab Five from Michigan. And the place was packed at 14,000 people. You know, that was Steve Fisher taking them into our building. And obviously, they smacked us around quite a bit. When we drew, like, Rolly Massimino, when he was with UNLV, he brought his team to play. You know, Tom Izzo brought his team to play. You know, John Thompson brought Georgetown to play. Those are the true sellout games. Beyond that, unless they kind of change conferences, perhaps, maybe, I don't even know. But it's a tough draw for basketball, even at 5,000, 6,000 seats.
Yeah. But now I want to go back to Michael for a second. Michael has done some color commentating with the women's basketball team. Lady Vikes, what a year, Michael, right? But could you envision what the atmosphere would be if they're in a new arena that maybe hold 6,000 seats? Could you envision what that might be like?
I can absolutely envision it, and it would be amazing to be a part of that, because, you know, sitting there calling games, you're very excited because you're in the moment, but you also look around in the stands, you're like, there should be so many more people here, or there are more people here, but it doesn't necessarily feel like that. When you have that smaller stadium, you're going to have crowds more bunched up, closer, people feeding off of people, and it would really, you know, boost the atmosphere of men's and women's basketball for sure for Cleveland State.
Yeah. Well, Ron, you and I grew up in Cleveland, and we have seen the evolution of new arenas and stadiums. And I can think back to the days when the Cleveland Indians, now Guardians, were playing up on Lakefront Stadium.
Right.
70,000 seats. And when 4,000 or 5,000 people would show up, it was... It was scary.
Yeah, the true fans came out for game two, not opening day, and that's maybe about 7,000 people next day. So,
yeah. Now, regardless of the size of the venue, Ron, how do facility managers look to ensure safety and security of patrons during events? Because let's face it, safety and security are a bigger issue today than they were 20 years ago. So what, you know, when you're looking at designing a new facility, what's going through your mind from a safety and a security standpoint?
You're kind of looking at entry points in and how to basically make sure that guests can be scanned in a comfortable setting, also allowing and ensuring that people can get through to their seats comfortably as well. You're basically looking at exit points, you know, for egress and emergency purposes. You know, where do you put, you know, your Evolve sticks if you want to go that route, as opposed to a magnetometer in terms of entry points and searching people? You know, that entry point element is starting to change every day. You're now seeing buildings put in, as I mentioned, the Evolve stick, where you're just kind of walking. You keep walking. You know,
yeah,
the Browns do that, right?
The Browns have that technology now, and I saw it on display at the National Sports Room. Like, nobody wants to take out their keys and their wallet. They're, you know, and they just want to get there. And that new technology, it's here, right?
Absolutely. We're trying to implement that here at Severance Music Center. They've had zero security elements in place since the building opened in 1931. There's no security on staff. There's no one checking bags. And people have commented, you know what, this is a different age. You know, everybody's a target, no matter what venue they're in. So, you know, we have to ensure that our safety and security procedures are in place. We have to maintain our staff is trained, you know, taking them out to the IAVM safety and security seminar, having people come in and do talks and things of that nature, you know, tabletop
So you just said something there that a lot of our audience would not be familiar with, the IAVM. Can you take a minute and just share with our listeners what the IAVM is and the role it plays with facilities?
Sure. The IAVM is the International Association of Venue Managers, which if you're a venue operator, you should be a member of this organization. It's basically the governing body for policies, procedures, guidelines of all things venues. They were the first on board to really, really drive home the COVID policies and helped us learn over here in our facility. They offer training courses in safety and security, things like guest experience. There's a IAVM venue manager school where I attended many years ago, and I'm sending one of my directors here to that in June. It's a two-week course. It's year by year. It's 1 year. It's 1 week. The second year is the second year is the second week. And you're basically learning all aspects of venue management from top to bottom, from the GM position to the back of house. And the International Association of Venue Managers wrote a textbook a few years back. And I actually use that textbook for some of my facility management courses because it's very well written. It's a defining guidebook to help us guide through all of our policies and procedures, as I mentioned, and all things venues.
Yeah, and I can still remember to this day the changes that 9/11 brought to security in facilities and venues, you know, across the country. So, and I think that's a good point, Ron, for our listeners. Like, you might go into facility management in 2023, but it's ongoing education, and things are going to continue to evolve. So, what they're learning in the classroom today, they better continue that education through IAVM.
Right. And one of the courses I teach is the Entertainment Event Management course. I've been teaching that for the last 3 years. One of the subject matters that we deal with is two different areas. It's the Who concert in Cincinnati back in the 70s, and then the Astroworld fiasco in Houston, which just took place a couple years ago. And students get the opportunity to take a look at video footage from both elements, from the Cincinnati Riverfront Coliseum back in the day, and then just recently in Houston at the Astroworld Fest. And they get to hear from different dynamics of security people and their thoughts and processes of how both were handled. The Astroworld scenario is a real study for anybody that wants to learn safety and security in venue management, because it tells you all the things that were not done correctly. When they had 65 people in triage, as soon as the gates open up, you know you've got a problem, and the concert's still 3 hours away. So all those dynamics are in place with that.
Well, and that's what's got to keep facility managers up at night. When you get 10, 20,000 people, mm-hmm. you know, let's go to an NFL stadium, that many people in a concentrated area, if you can't manage their flow of traffic, you're going to have some, problems on your hand. And that's something. So one of the other things that continues to become bigger and bigger is this whole concept of sustainability mm-hmm. and environmental concerns. So you've seen some changes there in your career. Talk to our audience a little bit about, you know, what should we be designing in the arenas of tomorrow to make them more eco-friendly?
Well, basically, I mean, Live Nation really wrote the handbook on sustainability. I mean, they do a great job with their outdoor amphitheaters. They've got a whole department based on, you know, composting and sustainability at the end of concerts. Their crew comes on board when the show is over. So they've got a crew working from 2 a.m. until 7 a.m., you know, recycling and things of that nature. Unfortunately, here at the orchestra, again, we are somewhat behind the times in terms of sustainability. We're never going to be a LEED certified, you know, building. But again, when you look at Blossom, you look at some of the outdoor amphitheaters, they're doing a great job of sustainability for waste afterwards and so on. We are running a more efficient process here in terms of our HVAC, our energy consumption and things of that nature. So we've done some advanced work here on upgrading our HVAC systems, which allows us better airflow and more control on our energy consumption.
All right. You said something there that students would probably pick up in your class, but you said LEED certified. What are you talking about there? What does that mean?
What you're talking about basically is people that are certified in any type of, and it's basically new buildings. So, you know, I never had the opportunity at Wolstein to be LEED certified, but you're going to be LEED certified on your energy consumption, you know, your sustainability programs, all that they take into account to get a LEED certification. There's silver, gold, different platforms of what you achieve. I know when I was at the convention center, we were striving to be a LEED silver certified building. Some people can't manage or get up to that whole gold element, but most new buildings will achieve a gold LEED certified standard.
Cleveland State University's new Sports and Entertainment Management program, where students can turn their passion for sports and entertainment into a rewarding career, gain hands-on experience, and learn from industry experts in the rapidly growing field. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
Okay. Quick question. And when you think about it, if you're the general manager of a facility, you're going to be working with a number of vendors and service providers. So share with our audience, what does that mean? Because somebody coming to the game might not know that there's another company that's in charge of concessions and that sure. you, the facility manager, have agreed to bring in Aramark as the concessionaire, right?
Right. You've got some big players out there in the concession world. You've got an Aramark. You've got a Delaware North. And those folks are basically brought on board as an outside contractor to help you generate revenue through food and beverage operation. They're trained in that area. They know firsthand how to run a concessions operation, a catering operation, you know, back of house, dressing room catering, and so on. But there's other service providers too, is like Peer Group Security, T-shirt security, that you bring on board to help you build a better security platform during your events in conjunction with your local police department. So some buildings are unionized. Some buildings have a stagehand union. Some buildings have a ticket sellers union. So those are also considered not so much vendors, but a part of your organization, but still working in hand and providing a service where your full-time employees are not getting involved. Here at Severance, we had difficulty getting a food operator post-pandemic. I have taken on the role of bringing concessions in-house. We brought catering in-house. Our missing element right now is our restaurant. That still remains closed, but we hope to open that very soon. But there are people trained in the food and beverage operation to do that.
Right. So one of the buzzwords that Michael took away from class in the fall is this whole concept of outsourcing. Mm-hmm. Most venues outsource concessions. So the question I have for you is, why would the Cavaliers or the Guardians or the Browns outsource their concessions instead of doing that themselves?
They basically don't want, number one is liability. I mean, they want the contractor to have the liability. It's a much easier way for them to generate revenue without the hassle of bringing it in-house. So it was a struggle for us to bring it in-house. I mean, we had an outside vendor. You're now talking about hiring staff. You're talking about paying benefits. You're talking about regular employees, time off, things of that nature, watching overtime. You know, how do we structure this so it benefits us? We made it work here because we're a smaller venue, but a much larger venue such as the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse absolutely needs an outside contractor to manage your food and beverage operations.
So go share with the audience, go back to your days at the Wallstein Center. Mm-hmm. A lot of college arenas and stadiums will outsource as well. They don't want to be in the business of making nachos and everything else that goes with it, right?
Correct. Yeah, we did the same thing at Wallstein. We had National Concession Company was our company that did our food and beverage. They were the brothers that ran the concessions at the National Air Show. The Axelrod family, and they were our contractor for concessions, for catering, and so on. You know, they become a part of your family in the venue business. They're part of your team and so on, but they take on their liability. They take on the risk. They're hiring their own people. You know, we just kind of become monitors of what they're doing to watch over their processes to make sure they're abiding by our guidelines and so on. They were a good operator for us.
Right. Now, by and large, most municipal arenas and stadiums on their own lose money. Okay. but so now you got this push pull, you're running the building, you're under pressure to maximize revenue, but at the same time, make a great experience for your patrons. How do you balance all that out?
Yeah, it's another challenge. I mean, it goes back to your original question about challenges facing facility managers, and creating revenue is a big challenge. And that's your overall goal, is to generate revenue as much as you can for your university, for your city, you know, ordinance, your municipality, and so on. But it's more or less along the lines of, what's the best right fit act to bring in? What's going to generate money for us? What's going to lose money for us? What do we stay away from? You know, we've got to generate revenue. We can't basically just bring in anything just to create revenue. We've got to monitor our staffing levels. We've got to monitor every aspect of what we're doing. And when it comes to generating revenue, we have to make sure that, first and foremost, that's the university's top of mind, is that's what they want us to do. And if we are not generating revenue, you know, at that time we were with a private management company. If we're not generating revenue, we're going to be out of our contract and they're going to bring somebody else in. But with all that goes on in terms of basketball practice and basketball games, and you have to justify basically why you didn't generate the numbers you did. Well, you know what? I've got so many practices here, I couldn't bring this event in. Or I had a game here for a women's team that's going to draw 50 people. You prevented me from doing this event. You know, Michael Schwartz, who was a former university president, wouldn't allow us to do mixed martial arts events. We did one and generated quite a lot of money. I don't want to say a bit, but a lot of money. He said, no more. Just not my type of speed. I don't want that kind of event on campus. So we were forbidden to do mixed martial arts concerts. And one other event he did not allow us to do, we did an event with Mike Tyson. It was a meet and greet up on the fourth floor, and he said he never wants that guy in our campus again. So, again, you have to get every event approved by your university administrator. You're just not out there signing contracts saying, yeah, we're bringing this person and so on. You know, from the slightest Barney show for a family to a Marilyn Manson show, all of those had to be approved by a university administrator before we were able to bring them in.
And right. So I'm going to pull Michael back into it because his generation is going to be responsible for creating new events that Ron and I never would have thought of. So when I think of new events, I don't know. People are going to arenas to watch, this blows my mind, to watch esports. So, Michael, I know this is a hot button for you. You're a gamer, but could you see yourself going to an NBA arena to watch a major esport competition?
Given the right platforms and depending on how much promotion went into it, I could absolutely see myself going because I'm, like you said, I'm a huge gamer. I love video games. And that is a incredibly growing field. I mean, we have a Division I scholarship athletes, esports at Cleveland State now. This is something that is going to continue to grow. And then we're going to have who knows what the next thing is. There's going to be an esports, but it's going to be for virtual reality or augmented reality and different things like that. So being able to have the ability to bring in those groups, especially these young people who we have some expendable income and we are willing to do that for entertainment, whereas maybe prior generations are not going to go spend as much money on entertainment as we are. But that's a great thing and could absolutely boost the revenue of any venue.
All right. So, Michael, I want to stay with you. And as our listeners get to know your background a little bit, during the Army and post-Army, you got to be pretty good at flying drones. And now we have professional drone racing that happens, Ron. I don't know. I've seen a little bit on YouTube or whatever that professional drone races in arenas and stadiums. So, right. Michael, with your background, maybe you could create an event there.
I would be very interested in seeing what those events look like. I've watched them on TV because they're actually very, very exciting. But I don't know what would go into actually putting on one of those in a venue. I would absolutely be interested because I have, you know, some knowledge. I have a passion for that. I think that you're going to need a fairly large facility based on what some of those can do.
But we, in our roles at Cleveland State, we're getting to know a lot of key people in the sport and entertainment industry. And I had the ability to go out to the Spire Institute. If our listeners have never been there out in Geneva, the Spire Institute has the largest indoor track and field facility stadium in the country, and they've done drone racing out there. So, Michael, like, how fast are these things going when they're doing these indoor drone races?
So you're going to get some upwards of 50, 60 knots. For anybody who doesn't know what a knot is, that's a nautical mile per hour as opposed to your standard statute miles per hour. So they're moving.
Right, right. And I don't know. We'd have to go and look at it, but they're racing through obstacle courses. And
yeah, they have to do different loops and make it through, 180 degree turns and hit loops. So it's very, very exciting.
So Ron, put your safety hat back on. You're the general manager of the facility. You want a bunch of drones racing around inside?
Well, then you go back to the revenue question. If it's making money, yes. I mean, yeah. I would love to have that, basically.
All right. So I'm going to throw the mic over to Michael and see what kind of questions he might have for you, because he's met a lot of students in our program, mm-hmm. and sure. Some of them would aspire to run an arena or a stadium someday. So, Michael, what questions have you got for Ron on facility management?
So I've actually got a couple. We talked about a little earlier, sustainability and security protocols when it comes to running these events. I remember watching the Super Bowl and the power goes out in the middle of the Super Bowl. what goes through a facility manager's mind when something like that happens? Because now, for me, immediately security pops into my mind is what's going to happen now that the power is out.
And Ron, before you answer that question, this podcast is rated PG. So be careful what you say.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you want to cry help in the middle of the field, basically. Yeah. But you have to remain calm, obviously. You know that things are going to get corrected. That is a major, major malfunction that took place during the Super Bowl. It's a matter of making sure you've got your staff, your leadership staff, getting together immediately to see where the issue is, to see how quickly it can get corrected, what measures had to be taken. We had not a similar situation, but we had a near catastrophe at Blossom for our Harry Potter film, which you may have heard through the media as being a slap in the face to the Cleveland Orchestra in terms of how it was handled. The rain came and lightning came at the worst possible time ever. And that was as soon as the gates opened up to the public, where then the safety and security moderator for Blossom Music Center had to put his hat on and say, look, folks, we can't put these people in harm's way. We've got to get them back to their vehicles or have them shelter in place. So it's an immediate reaction that has to take place. You can't just sit there and think about, you know, what's next or pull out drawings and things of that nature. You've got to immediately react and see what measures had to be taken. And that basically comes from the reliability of how strong your leadership team is surrounding you. You know, where is your lead engineer? Where is your chief fire marshal? You know, all of those people in place to make sure crowds are understanding what's happening, crowds are understanding where we are at certain points of getting this thing corrected and so on. With rain coming down and lightning coming down, very difficult to communicate and to basically move procedures in place that you normally would. So this was a learning experience for us at Blossom with the orchestra. We immediately had to create a crisis of communications plan because they didn't have one here. And I, like I said, this was a bad timing situation where as soon as the gates opened, lightning, thunder, rain, all came together. It may never happen again, you know, based on the timing, it may never happen again, but we still now have to have our proper procedures in place to make sure that we are covered the next time it does happen.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you taking me through that, Ron. One last question for me, Jim, and then I'll relinquish the floor back to you, gentlemen. But what advice would you give to somebody who is interested in pursuing a career in facility management for these types of venues?
It's a great, great career opportunity. I've loved every minute of it. I'm enjoying my time here at Severance as much as Blossom, as much as Wolstein Center. It's very rewarding. It has its challenges, like we discussed throughout the podcast. But you basically get involved in my day of getting involved. I remember the date and everything. It was September 9th, 1991, where I was on the arena floor measuring out seats for our opening event, which was Randy Travis and Alan Jackson. That was when Alan Jackson was not the headliner. He was the opening act. And you hit the ground running. And when you look back at it and say, wow, this has been a very rewarding career. You stick with it. You have to have the mentality that, you know, there are some challenging times. There are some long days, some long hours. For example, the 2000-2005 NCAA men's tournament, we knew that they were loading in Monday morning, and we knew they wouldn't load out till the following Saturday evening. So you have that mindset in your head saying, you know what, this is going to be a grueling week. Let's do it. Let's put our best foot forward for the NCAA. It's going to be over. We'll move on to the next event. The next event could be a rock concert. We had 4 days of Drew Carey, Brad Paisley, Aerosmith, and then Gwen Stefani from a Friday through a Monday. And that was all in the middle of a snowstorm that came through Cleveland. So it was very challenging. No one on my team complained. They all, I don't want to say they enjoyed it, but basically we all got through it. It was rewarding for us when Gwen Stefani loaded out on Monday evening to say, man, we just had 4 great shows in this building. Everyone was sold out. We all did a great job. It was a very rewarding experience for all of us.
Well, thanks, Ron.
So Ron, that raises a point, and I like to tell students that when you get into the sport or entertainment industry, it's a dysfunctional lifestyle. Okay. You're going to be working hours and putting on events that your friends are going to enjoy the entertainment. But there's something in the air when you work hard behind the scenes to make these events happen. And that opening tip or that opening song or that opening of the show, and you're looking at a packed house, that ties into the job satisfaction that comes with this industry.
Absolutely. My greatest reward, and just exactly what you're saying, Jim, is I was on the fourth floor of Wolstein Center the very first time we did the NCAA men's tournament, and it was St. Bonaventure playing Kentucky in the opening game. And I happened to come down. I had not seen the arena as of yet, and I happened to come down right at the opening tip, as you mentioned, and it was the most tremendous scene I've ever seen in my life. And just to see those schools performing in that building and their fan base behind them, and then watching the next set of teams come in and play. That game went into triple overtime, and Kentucky actually won. But it was such a great, great adrenaline rush for all of us just to hear the crowd and see the crowd roar for those games.
Right. And that's one of the cool things about our program as we kind of redo the curriculum moving forward. But we're really going to stress that our students do two internships before they graduate. And, you know, you've worked with a lot of interns over the years, and sometimes they're going to know if this business gets in their blood that,
right, exactly.
That okay, working crazy hours, but man, what a rush it is to be around it. So one of the things that, and I'm doing a little bit of self-promotion on our program, but I think you're going to take an intern or two from our program this summer to basically be with you out at the Blossom Music Center.
Sure. Yeah, we'd love to have them.
To help keep an eye on the overall operations that Live Nations does when they're using your facility. So like if I was an intern with you and shadowing you on a given night, what would we be looking at out at Blossom?
Well, you're looking at people arriving, and I mean people arriving, meaning your staff arriving, putting them in place. You'll be looking at pre-event briefings. You'll be looking at security briefings. You'll be listening and looking at radio calls to open gates. You'll watch people come in. You'll watch people being searched. All the things you would normally go through yourself for a regular concert, you can now see that take place. You know, people coming with families, people coming all excited to see the show. You'll see lights go down. You'll see basically the roar of the crowd and the artists come on stage. You'll see all that taking place, and then you'll experience it in a different look because you'll be a part of behind the scenes to see how all this unfolds from back of house to front of house. You know, how do ushers interact with each other? How do ushers and ticket takers interact with the general public? How do stagehands and back of house personnel interact with the artists and things of that nature? So you'll see all those elements in terms of, man, this is a great experience. It's work, but it's still a great rewarding experience in return.
Right. Well, listen, this has been a great podcast, but I cannot let you go without giving you a chance to talk about something that you started a number of years ago, and you're going to be doing it again this summer, and that is our Sport Management Institute. What a great opportunity. And some of our listeners might know of high school kids that would be interested in this. So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about the Sport Management Institute that you brought to Cleveland State and are going to continue to run moving forward?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So a few years back, we basically developed the Sport Management Institute as a means to draw people to the Cleveland State campus in various ways. I just basically had a difficult time with our university sitting in the middle of three professional sports teams, less than a mile from campus. Then you have a great sports commission down the street as well. Your steps from Playhouse Square. You have all this taking place in a vibrant downtown. You have apartment buildings going up because people are moving downtown. You know, I'm a downtown resident myself. My wife and I have been downtown for 12 years now. You have all this excitement taking place, yet we should be showcasing this for up-and-coming students who have an interest in the sport entertainment industry. So I started to put some thoughts together and how we can make this work, started reaching out to, you know, the professional teams, the Cavaliers, the Indians, and so on, met with the sports commission folks. They were all on board. That was a great idea. Live Nation had a part in it as well. We took students out to the Pro Football Hall of Fame so they could learn about that type of work as well. And it's just a great, great resource for kids to take part in what we're offering downtown. But in return, it gives them the opportunity to see what our university offers in terms of our sport and entertainment curriculum on campus. And with the hopes of, we can basically bring students to campus through this resource.
So, Michael, go back to your high school years. If you could have spent a week, a Monday through a Friday, coming to campus and listening to different speakers from the Browns, the Cavs, the Guardians, the Sports Commission, the concert industry, go back in time, would have been a pretty cool experience.
I would have definitely enjoyed it. My parents would have enjoyed me doing that as well, because it probably would have kept me out of a lot of trouble. but I finally made it here, and I'll hopefully be able to see, you know, this program continue to grow as you guys continue to do your work here at Cleveland State.
All right. Well, hey, Ron, one of the things that, as we're wrapping up here, we really have an embarrassment of riches right outside our front doorstep. And you just said that. So students that are looking to come to Cleveland State and learn about the sport or entertainment industry, plenty of opportunities. We can't thank you enough for all that you're bringing to our program as a member of the faculty, your expertise on facilities, and really your continued work with our Summer Sport Management Institute. So thanks for joining us today.
No, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate the invite. And again, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share what I've learned for the past 30 years and the opportunity to share, you know, details about the Sport Management Institute as well.
Well, gentlemen, as I like to say as we close these episodes out, Vikings row together. So it's been great getting you all together tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. All right, guys, that was Inside the Business of Sports. I am Michael Carlisle, and for Professor K and Ron Wilner, we're saying thank you, and we will talk to you guys next week.